Okay, we're going to do, I think this is number five, Shiur number five in the making of modern Judaism. I think it's one of my favorite Rabbanim and his wife, Rabbi Yeshua Falk Katz, which in a lot of the encyclopedias you'll see him listed as Falk, even though that's really not his last name. Falk was a Polish acronym for Cohen. But his real last name was Katz. So just a couple of biographical notes. So he was born and raised in Poland. He's also, we've been speaking a little bit about the development of the Polish community in the 15th century, in the 16th century. Remember, it's a very, very new community. You have everyone moving over from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, and the Poles basically with open arms accepting the Jewish people there. This is the Goldene Medina of those days, and Poland is the big boy on the block. What Poland is doing, you see here, he's born in Lemberg, Poland, which later becomes Lvov, Russia. Why? Because Poland was the big boy on the block in those days, and they were continuing to expand into White Russia. Into the area of Lithuania. In those areas, the Council of the Three Lands and the Council of the Four Lands, it eventually comes. But Russia is slowly expanding. Poland is slowly expanding into Russian territory. They're taking over the Cossacks. They're creating this kind of, what's it called? They're creating a fiefdom there with many, many serfs, and the Jews are serving a very significant purpose as the money lenders and tax collectors in under this system. It doesn't bode well for their relationship with Polish and Russian peasants, but for the time, it's the most lucrative position they've ever had in their history in Europe. It's much better than their position that they had in Western Europe, especially since it seems, at least at this time, that there's no reason that the Poles would be kicking the Jews out anytime soon, since they invited the Jews to come there. Again, if you have a prohibition of usury from the Catholic Church prohibiting Christians from taking what's it called? Interest one from the other. So then you really need Jews there to make your economy run. And the Poles, like I said, were very interested in bringing them in. Yeah.
Yeah, but the Jews probably still couldn't be comfortable because they just felt, let's say that king died, a new king comes in and reverse
You know, the
everything.
Nature of the Jewish experience in exile is that no matter where you are, you're never going to feel totally comfortable. So yes, that is part of the experience. But Rav Yeshua Katz is born into the second or even third generation of those living in Poland, and he's growing up in a different society, let's say, than his teacher, Rav Moshe Isserles. Rav Moshe Isserles is really a revolutionary in terms of creating a notion of Polish minhag, creating a notion of Ashkenazi Jewry that has kind of some sort of unified name to it. He's creating this notion of a community here, and Rav Falk is growing up in that created community. And he turns out to be quite an extraordinarily bright person, and he founds a yeshiva in Lemberg that produced numerous, numerous outstanding scholars. Basically, almost the entire next generation of scholars are based on are were taught by Rav Falk or Rav Katz and his students. He was very lucky. He declined rabbinical posts consistently, believing that it would take too much time away from his learning. Part of the way he did this was he was supported by an extraordinarily wealthy father-in-law who was one of the Parsanim, the one of the people Parnasim, excuse me, one of the people who was really main supporter of all the institutions in Poland at the time, a man by the name of Yisrael Idols. Who he was very lucky to marry Reb Yisrael Idol's daughter, and we'll find out a little bit more about his daughter also because she was as impressive, if not more, considering that it was, Middle Ages Poland, probably more even more impressive than Rav Yehoshua Falk Katz. one of his main contributions to the history of halacha was, number one, he presided over the Council of the Three Lands. He was an expert in Jewish monetary law. And the Jews were given the right to self-government under Polish rule. They had the Council of the Three Lands, which later became the Council of the Four Lands, which was a unified rabbinic and lay leadership society, for which it was responsible to deal with all issues relating to Jews. And again, the Jews were given a good deal of freedom because of the role in which they played within society. No, much more powerful. This was an independent government governing body that had the right that was responsible for collecting taxes from the Jewish people and paying it to the Polish government. Basically, it saved the Jews from having to be serfs. It saved them from having to be serfs, and they couldn't own land, so they couldn't be sharecroppers. So basically, they were given. What it also did was it created a major ghettoization in Poland, which when it came down for the Great Cossack Rebellion, the Chmielnicki Rebellions in 1648 and 1649, Jews were very easy to find, also very unprotected, because they were they didn't suffer in the same way, let's say, the Cossacks and the Russians were suffering, so therefore they were left very vulnerable during these times and an easy target for rampaging peasantry.
Not everyone could be a tax collector. Not every Jew could be a money lender.
You'd be surprised.
So what other
jobs did they have? They were in the mercantile business. Movement of goods. They were in the mercantile business all over Poland.
Could they become doctors?
Whatever that was worth, you couldn't go to university because you had to be Catholic to go to university, right? Universities were controlled by the church. So that you couldn't do. So there were limited opportunities. If you want, there's some interesting kind of, I forget who it was, evolutionary psychology on why Jews have the penchants that they currently have for numbers and things like that. In that, basically, if you didn't have a penchant for numbers, you died, right? So who's going to, what type of genetics are going to be passed on to the next generation are people who have a knack for numbers. But
couldn't they work the land that they didn't own?
Yeah, but why would you want to sell yourself into slavery?
They rent the land.
Again, you don't rent land, right? Land was given over by the ruling government to noblemen. And then those noblemen would basically, in exchange for you basically indenturing yourself to them, you get to use the land and take a portion of it, and the vast majority of it you're giving over to the noblemen. Like I said, this was a much better position to be in. This was a much better position to... And I think also you're thinking, oh, there must have been millions of Jews. The population of the earth quadrupled in the 19th century or the 20th century. There were not, let's say there were 150,000 Ashkenazi Jews, and that's like a massive amount. Like, that's how many we're talking about. We're not talking about...
You think of like 3 million Jews.
Yeah, right? Yeah. If you go back to medieval Ashkenaz, in the going theory is anywhere between 10 and 25,000. Which, that's how many people live in the five towns now. So...
And obviously, you have the unusual nature of the Bielski brothers. They were farmers. Very rare.
Right.
But that helped because they understand.
Potentially. Anything, yes. That's why, by the way, you have that massive changeover in the Zionist movement is, the farming. That was like a big... that lasted about one generation. But, before we went back to the more lucrative businesses.
High-tech.
Yeah, to high tech. But, yeah, all right. So, what makes him amazing and really special, Rav Katz, Rav Yehoshua Katz, is he was the first one who decided that there should be a super commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The goal or the purpose of writing the Shulchan Aruch was that it should be a reference work for halacha, and it should be the final word on all halachic issues. And what does he do? He basically undermines the entire perspective of the Shulchan Aruch. He's the first one. He wrote his first work, which was the Sefer Me'irat Inayim. The Sefer Miratinaim, fondly known as the Sma, is an extraordinarily creative and innovative and insightful work that basically takes on some of the issues, the broader issues that are brought up by the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is written only a generation earlier. The Shulchan Aruch is end of the 16th century. He's writing at the beginning of the 17th century. The Sefer Miratinaim, the Sma, so the plan was, he says in his introduction, is to write on the entire four sections of the Shulchan Aruch, on Or HaChaim, Choshen Mishpat, Evan Ezer, Yerideya. He does not complete it. He's only able to write it on the Choshen Mishpat, on the monetary areas. Again, hence his reputation as being one of the experts in areas of monetary law in Judaism. He did, however, finish another work on the Tur. The Tur, if you remember, was this work by Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, the precursor to the Shulchan Aruch, was also a codifying work, but it was based on the Piske Halacha of the Rafsh, of the Torah's father, Rabbeinu Asher. And it was very much Ashkenazo-centered, but it was kind of a good template for which Rav Yosef Karo used as his starting off point to write his Beit Yosef, right? If you remember, again, going back to the first year that I gave, the Beit Yosef was a work that summarized every halachic sugya, and came to a conclusion following the path of what he called the Shlosha Amudei Hara, the three pillars of Psak, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. Okay, and again, he weighted it towards Sephardic Psak, and the Rama came along and glossed over it and kind of brought in what the Ashkenazic glosses. The Prisha, or Rav Katz, decides to write his work now because he has issues with Rav Yosef Karo's work on the Tur. What's his issue with it? His issue is, I mean, if I can make a broad statement about it, his issue is, it's not a work on the Tur. What is it? It's a work on Rav Yosef Karo. He merely uses the Tur as his map. And so Rav Falk says, well, no one's really explored the Tur for being the Tur. So he basically, in his introduction to the Sma, he summarizes his five purposes in writing his Prisha and his Drisha. What were his five purposes? So here I brought for you the issues. So he says, Ha'echad. He says, number one, Shehu Zal, and he's referring here to Rav Yosef Karo, Katvo v'chibro l'fi rochav sichlo v'da'ato hatzlula u'v'kiyuto hagdola. He says, Rav Yosef Karo was so amazing, so great, and he had such a broad range of knowledge, such a clear mind, and he had so much at his fingertips. And he says, everything was so clear in his head, but mitochach irbeiv dvarav, v'katav lo nashmishna megemara, v'divrei haposlim v'achashuva asher chayim la'ot ha'adim, u'pirsha makol yachad. He explains everything together, he says. The Rav Yosef Karo never says, let me just explain this opinion or this thing. He goes, I'm going to explain to you, the laws of this Malacha of Shabbos. There's 14 Gemaras that all relate to it. Let me summarize them for you. There's four general different approaches, and this is the approach that I'm going to tell you. And what happens? He has everything confused and mixed up together. And he says, V'kashe l'chol me'ayim l'varer mitochuch biur hadin. But what do you want? You don't want to know about Borer. You want to know how I should eat watermelon on Shabbos. But, you're going to read this Rav Yosef Karo, you're not going to know anything. How would you pass into this? So I'm going to take out of his, big umbrella of halacha that he's discussing, the broader sugya, I'm going to pull out a nugget and I'm going to be able to focus on it in a way that Rav Yosef Karo was not able to do. That's number one. Number two, he says, Hasheni sharav mirov harifuto b'kiziyato, because he was so brilliant. Notice everything is, Rav Yosef Karo missed these things, not because he did a bad job, but because he was so brilliant, so beyond understanding. So he says, Hiniach milechto biur lekama dvarim shein nilamim ustumim lerovim yonam shebidoreinu. He says, listen, Rav Yosef Karo wasn't interested in contemporary psak halacha. He was interested in understanding the broad range of the sugya. So what do you do? There are certain things that are very relevant to our generation and to our experience that Rav Yosef Karo leaves out and that are essential to us in terms of understanding. And he says, "Ubiprat betur choshen mishpat asher bon dinei mamano shalav amru." He says, where in particular? In particular, in the realm of economic law. Remember, this is his field. He's the economist. He's the rabbinic economist. He knows economic law. He knows these things better than anyone else. So he says, Rav Yosef Karo missed a lot of things. My hunch is, one of the reasons Rav Yosef Karo missed a lot of things is because for Rav Yosef Karo, it wasn't a live issue as much as it was for Rav Falk or for Rav Katz. Why? Rav Yosef Karo is living in Safed. It's a relatively very small community. He may be dealing with, you know, a shaila here, a shaila there in terms of monetary issues, but what's Rav Katz doing? He's setting the standard for a living, breathing economic system controlled by Jews and governed by halacha. So of course, this is going to be a much more lively issue for him. And it's kind of one of the sad issues today, if you think about it, that Dine Mamonos in general as a field of study, we don't even think about it just because it's so rare, you know, that it comes to us that we're dealing with, you know, economic, you know, tort law issues in halachic terms. But, you know, the lion's share of halachic thinking is not in, you know, how you put on your tefillin or how you do these various things. The lion's share of halachic thinking is in the law, so it is in tort law. Is in you know, interpersonal relationship law. So he said he feels that Rav Yosef Karo didn't do justice to Choshen Mishpat, to that area of halacha. The third part, what does he do? The tour, Rav Yaakov Balaturim, is merely one source among sources for Rav Yosef Karo, right? Rav Yosef Karo, what's his goal? His goal is not to interpret the tour. His goal is to understand the sugya using the tour as his skeleton. So if he has like a little question here that something doesn't make in the tour, so what does he do? All right, Tzarich Iyun, let's move on. He's one more opinion in the bunch, you know? And if it doesn't make sense. So he says, Harav hiksha bekamu kushiyot al divrei haposkin, ubiprat al divrei hatur. Rav Yosef Karo asked a number of questions on various poskim, here probably Ashkenazic poskim, and in particular the tour, v'satar divrei, and in the end he disagrees with them because he thinks they're wrong. Fine, kol hakavod. Rav Yosef Karo is allowed to disagree with whoever he wants. He says, but anyone who's reading the Beis Yosef, what's he going to think? Choshvan letoeh, v'fabim hinichan etzirachiyun. He says, people are going to go read it and they're going to think, oh, he must be wrong. So someone needs to take up the mantle as the defender of the Torah. So I'm here to answer those questions that Rav Yosef Karo didn't answer in those defense. Number four, he says, the Torah was very careful in the way he wrote things. And again, because Rav Yosef Karo is not interpreting the Torah, he's looking at things more broadly. So what does he miss? He misses inferences within the Torah. Says the Torah had all these statements, all these inferred halachos that we can have, and when you're merely viewing the Torah as one more opinion amongst opinions, you're not going to be as likely to kind of infer or interpret a Torah closely. So he didn't like that one. And number five, he says, I don't agree with every halachic decision Rav Yosef Karo made. Okay, and here I am. He's the next generation. You know, he has it all in front of him. So that's my right, he says, to argue with him, even though he was great and smart and brilliant, etc., 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 and all the wonderful things. So here he says, he summarizes, as I said, he summarizes in very broad terms what his goal was in writing a commentary on the Torah, and then ultimately also a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. Again, he has a goal here of A, defending the tour, of kind of interpreting the tour for real, on bringing out his economic issues, which he feels were not necessarily discussed as much as they should have, and also, like I said, you know, kind of focusing as a commentary on the tour rather than using the tour as your jumping off point for writing your own book. Okay, so that's one of the things. Like, if you want to, like, a comparison, we discussed the Maharal, you know, a little while ago. So I said about the Maharal is, you know, sometimes you get the feeling when you're reading the Maharal, he's not learning Pirkei Avos, he's not learning Gemara, he's not learning Chumash, he's learning Maharal, right? He just needed an excuse to write the Sefer or to make his comment, so he has it there. So the Prisha says, listen, the Beis Yosef is a great book regardless, but what was he looking for in the end? In the end, he was looking for some sort of ma'arechet, some sort of, you know, kind of skeleton or book that will serve as the backbone of what his Sefer will be. And the Torah served out the convenient one, but, you know, I'm here to interpret the Torah.
Was there a reason why he wrote in like Rashi script rather than Hebrew?
The printer. Okay, yeah. Printers, in order to differentiate between who's writing what, use different forms of script, which is the famous thing, which is Rashi probably could not have read Rashi. Okay, but that's the famous thing. But it was merely a printer's decision. Okay. So who was Mrs. Katz or Bela Edel's Katz? So we find out about this because Rav Yosef ben Yehoshua Katz, the son of the Prisha, wrote an introduction to the Prisha. And in his introduction, after giving this great, wonderful, stupendous biography of his father about how, you know, he inspired him, he says, and you should know, I would not be doing justice to my family history if I didn't, you know, spill as much ink, he says, about his mother, Bela Edel's Katz. So Bela Edel's Katz grew up in the home of an extraordinarily wealthy man. You know, we spoke about Reb Yisrael Edel's and his wealth as the father-in-law of the Prisha. But Bela was educated, you know, far more than probably most women in her day, and she embraced her education, and she embraced also the opportunity that existed in being the wife of a brilliant scholar. So what does he say? He says, "Ulatzor b'milim yulchal." This is Rav Yosef ben Yehoshua Katz, the son of the Prisha, saying, "I can't stop and saying mila lot al sefer l'saper rov goldel tiferet yakar malot isha chashuva gvirat nuah v'chasida v'ashira halohi imi harabanit imi morati harabanit marat Bela." Okay, he says, "How can I possibly write any introduction or say anything without talking about the great, stupendous, amazing, modest, righteous, kind, etc., straight, you know, wonderful woman that was my teacher, my mother, the daughter of the katzin of the great prince and the great philanthropist Harav Yisrael Edels of Nafshah B'tzorah Chaim Tzoriah? Maybe she'd be bound up. So she'd be bound up with Rivka, Rachel, Leah, etc." Okay, so he said she was a guidepost to all of the women of her generation who looked to her. What?
Sorry, it's a weird order. Rivka, Rachel, Bilea, Visara.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I don't know if that means anything.
I think he's going backwards, but it is.
It's
I didn't.
Really.
Right.
So
he's rhyming. That's why. My apologies. Right. Nafshah B'tzorah Chaim Tzorah Imi Menu Rivka Rachel Lea Visara. Okay, and then he says, "Hamivia liimi morati zichrona levracha l'chol hakavod hazel uvala itra atara v'aita lo l'talmida le'ezer yitkasku b'torah." Okay, so what did she do? She was an assistant to him. He says to him and to his students in order that they should learn Torah. Ra'u abanot v'yashua ma'asan imim v'yikara. So. Okay, what did she do? Everyone would look to her, and they would see, and they would praise her for what? She made sure to guide them, him and his Talmidim, in the proper path. He says, everyone should see, should read about my mother, and they will learn to act similarly. So who was this? V'hine, he says, Af gambiota. Bat yichida itzel aviha hakatzin parnas. So she was an only child to her father, who was the great philanthropist Hador. Uviadal lo tavata kavat nasha. Right, she had basically, being the only daughter of the wealthiest man in town, she had the right to, you know, live it up, and she never did that. She lived instead, it said, a very modest life. Ilo astakein ma'asa nasha b'tanugei olam. right? She basically did not, you know, indulge in pleasures. She chose instead to indulge in the benefits of this world that would bring her the most reward in the world to come. What does he say about her? So he says about her, listen, he says, she was a great cook for Shabbos. She would send out, and she would always cook extra to make sure there would be plenty for poor people and for other people who might show up. And what does she do? This is the best part. V'kol yameha, all of her days, hein b'yamei choref, whether it was winter, hein b'yamei kayetz, whether it was summer, amda tamid b'rizrizu kodem or hayom, she would get up before sunrise, kama sharod, v'irbeit litpalel b'kavana b'dola b'tfilot v'tachnun l'fnei ha'makom baruch hu, she would get up and she would daven. Okay, v'yadam mafteach ezras nashim shaitza rishonim ibai beis kenezes. Where would she go to daven? Not in her living room. She held the key to what? To the women's section of the shul, and she would go there. And she would be the first one in shul and the last one out. Achar yitzias ha'ami yibetz ha'kenesh, shegmira tefilotea v'tachanea, v'achar tefila. Okay, and after she davin, lo sam nafsha l'shum davar batala, rak michayel uchayel, oseket petorah. What did she do? She was a wealthy woman. She didn't, you know, except for cooking for Shabbos, she probably didn't do much, didn't have many responsibilities around the house. So what would she do with her free time? Not, you know, go shopping on the equivalent of whatever it was, you know, Main Street in Poland. What would she do? She would sit and be oseket petorah, parsha shel yimei ha-shavua, im perish rashi, usham mefarshim. Right? She would sit and learn chumash, or the parsha of the week, with rashi and all the mefarshim, Kayadu elechol Talmud, avimori, as any one of my father's students will attest to, if you wanted to know the parsha, you go to my mother, right? All right, any one of them, because what would happen? They would all meochle shulchanos shetamir, asher yu potrana shulchan b'divrei Torah. Okay, so what would happen? They would all sit around the table and they would be sitting and learning Torah at the Shabbos table. Haisa ozeres. Kigever chaltzitz, she would gird her loins like a man. And what would she do? She would participate in the Torah discussions. And he says, ulefamim asher himtzia midata, ivapshat matok midvash, nofet titovna siftotea. Many times she came up with pshatos, which chidushim, that were sweeter than honey. Ubiprat, and in particular, bedine nashim ubehilchaz nida. Where does she have the first Yoetzet Halacha here? When she had particularly in the laws relating to women and in Hilchos Nida. Haisa baki kimat kechad mibalei hora. She knew it almost as well as one of the poskei halacha. Okay? Hibidur na marshir higisha betos nashim badlakas neros biyom tov. And she says, I have a problem with the way women light candles on Yom Tov. He says, v'tautam b'shtayim. She felt that there were two mistakes. This was her psak halacha. Number one, ha'echad, ma shenoheges liglos neros shel yontam kemo shel Shabbos. What would every woman do? They would light candles on Yom Tov the same way they would on Shabbos. So what do they do on Shabbos? They light the candles. They cover their eyes because they accept Shabbos by lighting the candles. They cover their eyes and then they say ladnik neros shel Shabbos. So it's like they're lighting the candles. Why don't they light it after the bracha like we do every other mitzvah? We don't like it after the bracha because our fear is that you've accepted Shabbos once you've lighted it. Well, you've accepted Shabbos once you've said the bracha, and then what are you doing? You're lighting on Shabbos. So shteis the halaga, Rebinson Bela Katz, Givalt on Yantif. What's the problem?
You can light.
Say the bracha first, right? So he says the ha'inu malikin sha tchila. And he says, the Rama quotes this practice that they do it even on Yom Tov. So he says, so she goes on to say, she says, obviously everyone knows that it's a machlokes haposkim, whether it's Kabbalah Shabbos is by the lighting, or love Kamasha Kasavatur. Everyone knows this machlokis, including Rebinson Bela Katz, right? Because we all knew this, right? And Viafa Bishnaktina Hakala Halacha de Inhilhasa Kabbalah Shabbos Ibad Lakas Neros the Shabbos came bitfilas arvish and mispalam rovat sibor bitchilasan. So even though we say that really Kabbal Shabbos is when during Ma'ariv, nevertheless, for women who don't always daven Ma'ariv, our fear is that's what's going to happen. Fine. So he says, so what's the problem? On Yantif, when should you make the bracha? You should make the bracha beforehand. Okay? And not only that, she says, maybe it's better if they did it after Ma'ariv also, and this way they could all be Makabel Shabbos together. And this was her psak halacha. This is what she felt that was the correct halacha. So you're like, all right, fine, that was her thing. Whoever heard of this. Go one generation later, Magen Avraham quotes this psak halacha. What does the Magen Avraham say? Achar lacha. So the Magen Avraham says, "Deim tivarech kabbalah Shabbos va'asr ladlik v'im kein biyom to tivarech v'har kach tagliv." So he says, on Yom Tov she should make the bracha and then make the bracha. Kein kasa b'sof sefer hadrisha be'evin ezer. That right, the drisha quotes this lahalacha b'shem imo in the name of his mother. So here he's referring to Rav Yosef Katz. Aval ein chachma leisha, says the Magen Avraham. Women have no wisdom. Delo chalku chachamim. No, chachamim didn't make any differentiation. Fine. That's what she says. Interestingly enough, Rav Yecheskel Landau, the author of the No Debi Yehuda, in his Dagol Mirvava, he thinks the Magen Avraham is dead wrong. He says the Magen Avraham, he says is wrong, and he says. He paskins like Rebinson Bela Edel Katz. So this, I think, in my mind, is the ultimate form of equality. Because, okay, you're not truly equal until they can bash you the same way they bash any other halachist. So the Magen Avraham, I think, gave her the greatest kavod of taking her on as he would the Sma himself, which is fascinating. One of the interesting issues, and I think it brings out, I think a number of things we've discussed. Number one is it'll bring out the Prisha or Rav Katz's approach to Talmud study, to study of the Tur, in terms of his inference in the language, and his focus on specific dinim that relate to those days. Number two, it will bring out the respect that he had for his wife. Just kind of in one issue. So we all know the famous issue that there is a statement in the Gemara that seems to prohibit women from learning Torah. It's only the statement of one opinion of one Amora. But nevertheless, the Rambam paskins it lahalacha that you can't teach Torah shebaal peh. You can't teach the oral law to women. Because Rov Nashim, the Rambam says, Datan Einmam Nechuvano. Most women, their minds are not properly attuned to their understanding, and they're ultimately going to take it into the wrong direction. That's what the Rambam says. The Tur quotes this Lahalacha. Beis Yosef says everyone holds like this and moves on without saying anything. Comes the Tur and says, no, Beis Yosef is trying to give you a broad issue of understanding the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. And he says, wait a minute. Let's read these words carefully. He says, Aval im lamda la'atma. He says, but let's say she learns. She picked up a sefer and started learning. Let's say she learns. Okay, on a rose, she yatsu me'arov. So what happens? Let's say she learns for herself and learns properly and understands properly. So there she basically takes herself out of the majority. Right, he knew what it meant for a woman to take herself out of the majority, at least in medieval Poland, right? And he says, "Ulekach chasav leil sheish leschar." Okay, so he says that if she's able to learn for herself and proves that she's understanding, so she removes herself from the majority, and he says this refers to a woman who has studied properly. Consequently, will not turn the words of Torah into words of nonsense. So he says, a father is forbidden to teach his daughter Torah lest she turn the words into the words of nonsense, since he does not know what lies in her heart. But once she starts learning, and she shows everyone that she's not going to turn it into nonsense, but she's going to, you know, produce, you know, great studies of Torah. So therefore, not only, he says, then you have a complete right to teach your daughter Torah. So here you kind of have, what do you have? You have the application of what he said he was going to do. right? He said, I'm going to, you know, focus on the details. I'm going to make inferences into language, and I'm not going to merely overlook things merely because I'm looking at things more broadly. I'm going to focus particularly on the language of the Torah. And so he takes the language of the Torah, Rov Nashim Da'atanei Melchubanos. He's very careful in terms of the Torah's language, and he makes his inference, and he paskins a contemporary Shaila based on that. So just a fascinating little, you know, kind of statement in the Prisha, you know, of Rav Katz's work, where he basically brings together, hey, the experience that he had with his very special wife, and also his kind of methodology for interpreting halacha and the Torah in general. And I think that's why I think Rav Katz in general is one of the more fascinating characters in history. In those terms, again, he was very much not an iconoclast. In that sense, he was very much considered part of the klal. And you see here just kind of how this kind of massive sea change. I think, you know, his lasting legacy, aside from his halachic positions that he's taken, is the notion of a super commentary on later works. You know, no one had written a super commentary on the Shulchan Aruch or on the Torah, except for Rav Yosef Karo, until, you know, Rav Katz kind of jumps into the water there and basically undermines the whole notion of codification in general. So the movement of codification lasted about a generation. Everyone's like, oh, we decided this is the halacha, nothing else, blah, blah, blah. This is what Ashkenazim are going to do. This is what Sephardim are going to do. That lasted about a week before someone said, well, wait a minute. How do we know that this is what we want to do? Before the Sma weighed in on it. And he, you know, he creates an explosion of super commentaries upon the Shulchan Aruch. And also, he's kind of opens the door for a real explosion in terms of Piskei Halacha and learning. And again, also, what he did for economic study of the tort law and similar is also, I think, part of his very much part of his legacy. So that is.
You said before that he taught pretty much every major figure who came after him in medieval Poland.
Yeah.
Is there any indication that any of those were women, or that any of those themselves taught women, or anything like that?
So I mean, Rav Yosef.
These great statements. Yeah. Was his wife really a one-off?
No. So Rav Yosef. Katz, his son, says that she inspired other women of her generation.
But we don't really know.
Like I said, if you're not writing Svarim, how are we going to know about you?
True.
That's the problem.
It's like publish or perish.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Right. I'm sure there were lots of, you know.
Your father's rich and your husband's rich.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm saying, you know what I mean? Like, there are some people, like, really, the countenance of history shone upon them for whatever reasons. So she happened, I mean, I'm sure she would have preferred to have siblings, but she happened to be the only child of an extraordinarily wealthy man who was interested in seeing that his daughter would be educated. She had the personality, clearly, that she was going to use her free time for study and not for, you know, other types of pursuits. And she married, you know, a guy who was bringing home, you know, Talmud scholars every Shabbos for her to test. So she kind of developed in that sense. Not everyone has that same type of benefit.
So there may have been other women.
There may have been.
Yentl,
right. That was not medieval Poland. That was
later on.
That was only 19th century Poland. Yeah.
Did you explain earlier on that this name Falk Katz?
So Falk. Yeah. So I like I said I always refer to him as Rav Yehoshua Falk, but I found out in my research that Falk was merely a name given to Kohanim.
What is it the acronym for?
I forget what it's the acronym for. It slips my mind for the moment. But
Katz
it's
also.
Yeah, yeah, but Katz is a real last. Yeah, but Katz is a real last name. Was the name? Yeah, I mean, yeah. But Pollux, Falk, it's all the same name. So it's. But not all of them are Kohanim either. So I'm not. I forget. I looked it up and I saw what it was. It was actually on Wikipedia, believe it or not. But that's what it is. So just to review. So he wrote the Sefer Mirati Nayin on the Shulchan Aruch Hoshe Mishpat. That's on monetary law and tort law, and then the Prisha and the Drisha on the Torah. We saw that was his inferential work, and then we saw his wife who was very much influential. In terms of his learning, in terms of his students' learning, I mean, who's to say if his students did not become as great as they became because of her involvement in their education?
The Jews have won a lot of economic Nobel
Prizes.
I said it's
who
not
wrote
a
Senorena.
Senorena. I don't know. I don't
think
know.
It was a woman, or do you think a man for a woman?
I think it was a man for a woman. I think a man for a woman. But
you said if he did a whole bunch of economic halachas, do we still hold by any of them or any of them?
Yeah, a lot of them are. I'm not involved in tort law, so I don't know when we're using the SMA as our source book, as our source for a psak halacha. So I'm not sure, but I'm not sure when, but I'm sure we do use it. You can't have someone that bright who isn't gonna. I'd be interested. I mean, I guess if someone wanted to write a PhD on something, you could write something on the SMA as an economic economic philosopher. The SMA's contribution to 16th century economics. I think that would be a real page turner. but yeah. All right, Shkayach, thanks for coming.